Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Francisco.
Good to see you. Where are we heading today?
Today we are in the month, we're in the month of April, and this is Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month. I'm going to make sure I get it all correct. And it's an interesting, not often talked about month, and it follows on the heels of Women's History Month, which I don't know if is accidental or if it's meant to be that way. But the primary victims of sexual assault are women and young girls and those that present as female. And so it's ironic that we move from Women's History Month into Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month, but we don't talk much about it. And I think part of the reason that we don't talk much about it is because we live a cultural story that is trying to sell this idea that women's rights do not need to be addressed, because since the 1970s and Title IX, it's all been good and women are in the workplace and they have opportunities and there's more women than men in college today and more women in graduate school. And so from the outside, there's this beautiful rosy picture that all is good for women. So let's stop talking about them as victims. And also as a side note, there's a lot of women who say, I don't want to be seen as a victim and I don't want to be lumped in with all those women because I can pull myself up now and I've made my own way. And so because we have this cultural story that there's nothing to see over here, we miss the fact that in this moment, there is a young woman or a young child being victimized every 73 seconds. So twice since I started talking, there has been an American sexually assaulted. And in every 9 minutes, that victim is a child. And sex trafficking is one of the largest crimes in the United States. And if we want to talk about sex trafficking, which isn't our topic today, we just have to look at the front page of some of our politicians and transporting young girls underage across state lines. That, by definition, is sex trafficking and is a federal crime. This happens every day. This county in San Luis Obispo, where we live, more than five times a year has some sort of bust of young women being sex trafficked from the valley to the coast. And it's in the paper, and then it's quickly dismissed and we move on. Maybe it's because it's not someone we know, or it's not publicized, or it's not someone that we have time to think about or care about, or in the time of the pandemic, how can we even talk about these things? But trauma for young women is so common. Some statistics put it at one in every two women will be sexually assaulted at some time in her life. So it's a huge issue and concern, especially if you have children. I have two daughters and a granddaughter. It's a huge concern for me, because when you have a cultural story that says this isn't an issue anymore, and it is an issue, you have been assaulted or you have been sexually abused, or you have been trafficked, it's much harder to talk about it because the rest of the culture is saying, nah, that doesn't happen here. So in some ways, even though we're in 2021, we're actually further away from recognizing and protecting women and children than we were in the 1970s, because at least in the 1970s, it was in our face. There weren't laws protecting women. There weren't laws protecting children. And so there was a fight to be had. But here we are in 2021, and we have laws in place that should protect women and children, and yet they aren't enforced. Convictions aren't made. Things are overturned. Victims won't come forward. And so now it's even more difficult to have this conversation because we think it's all been taken care of, and yet it hasn't. So that's what's on my mind today. And it's not all doom and gloom, because my guest today has been an advocate for victims' rights for the last 20 plus years. And she brings a wealth of experience and information about healing and trauma and sexual assault from her own life experience and also as her work in the public sector. I've had this guest on once before. We had such a great conversation. It's one of those conversations where you think, oh, wait, I just made a friend. And now I just want to hang out with this friend. And it's taken us almost 3 years to be able to get back together and continue our friendship. So without going too much farther into it, my guest today is Jennifer Storm. She is a survivor, the author of 6 critically acclaimed books about addiction and recovery and victims' rights. She has over 23 years of active recovery. Jennifer has spent her entire adult life advocating for victims of crime, including 7 years spent as a victim advocate for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Her books include Blackout Girl, An Awakening Blackout Girl, A Survivor's Guide for Healing from Addiction and Sexual Trauma, and a recently released updated version of Blackout Girl with new content to bring it into the hashtag MeToo era. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And although we don't have our phones open as we usually do, you can still be part of the conversation by sending us an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can join us on our Instagram Live. Just go to The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram and join, and you can ask a question that way. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our shows by visiting Apple Podcasts or wherever you do your podcasting. And as always, you can ask one of your children or grandchildren how you can find the podcast. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe and the shows will be there for you to listen at your convenience. So thank you for joining us today. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to start our conversation with Jennifer Storm. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And welcome to the show, Jennifer Storm, my friend across the country.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be back. I wish I was in studio with you, but this will work.
Well, so the last time you were in town, you were speaking here actually in San Luis Obispo.
Yes.
For the women, was it for the Women's Network or the, was it SAFE? I can't remember which group that you're speaking out for.
I think it was the Women's Network. I know it was a really large event. I got to meet your district attorney and some amazing individuals in your community and loved SLO, fell in love with it, would come back in a heartbeat.
Well, as soon as we get the all clear, you can come back and we'll do this together in the studio. But before we jump into where you are now, can you give the Cliff's Notes version of how you became Jennifer Storm, victim rights advocate?
Sure. You know, it really started in this kind of really horrible, dark way. I was raped at age 12. And it was this, as you can imagine, horrifically traumatizing and life-altering experience. And it shifted everything I thought I knew about the world and safety and security and how I felt about myself and my place in the world. And this was in the 80s. It was 34 years ago on Easter Sunday. So this Easter Sunday actually was rough for me because it's rare that April 4th actually falls on Easter Sunday, and that's what the date was in 1987. And so I had a harder time than I anticipated this past weekend, but got through it because that's what we do. There weren't the same supports back in the 80s. Like, really, it was almost non-existent. There were not rapid rape responses to the hospital. We didn't have a victim advocate. We did prosecute the adult who had raped me. I went through the rape exam with, you know, no assistance other than my mother there. And, you know, those moments that are so important, and that prediction and that preparation, and I didn't have that. So I didn't know what was happening to me. So the rape exam ended up being this secondary victimization, because it's, you know, just as invasive, if not in some ways more so, because you've got people plucking your hairs and scraping your fingernails, and no one's telling you that your body is evidence, but it is. And, you know, I watched my favorite Swatch rugby shirt get packed into a bag with this evidence tape on it. And again, no one was explaining anything to me. And I didn't know what was going on. I was very scared and I was very confused. And so I went through the criminal justice system that way also. I testified at the preliminary hearing, and I didn't know how to cope with what I was feeling, which was this catechism of emotions. And my parents, who were married, both were equally as traumatized. And what I know now, but didn't know then, was that they were both victims as children themselves. And then my father was also 1st Infantry Vietnam. So he had a whole host of PTSD that had never been addressed, never acknowledged. And so not only did what happened to me traumatize my parents, but it literally brought up to the surface all of their own childhood trauma, and it put it right in their face, and they didn't know how to handle it. And so we all just kind of pretended like it didn't happen, and we all went on our merry, dysfunctional way. And my merry, dysfunctional way took me down a path of drug and alcohol use, because I needed something to deal. I needed something to cope. And I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling. And so I spent 10 years of my life chasing, just running, right? Chasing an escape, and never really getting very far. I used to say I was an escape artist, but I never got away from myself, right? Because you can't escape your own brain. You can, I guess, momentarily, right? With the use of drugs and alcohol, but it's always a temporary relief, and usually with worse consequences when you come to and you realize that, oh, that was a mess. And so I did this for 10 years. During that time, I had suffered additional victimizations, which is not uncommon. And it eventually came to a head, and I won't go into the whole breadth of the story, right? That's why there's multiple books. Yes. But what ended up happening is my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she got really sick. And I was really deep in a crack cocaine addiction and active daily alcoholism. And I was able to kind of show up and be there for her. And we had a very dysfunctional relationship. It was abusive in and of itself, because again, she never got treatment for her abuse. So that kind of bled onto me, as emotional wounds do when they're left untreated. And so I was able to be there for her in her final days. In fact, she died in my arms on July 9th of 1997, literally, you know, almost 10 days or 10 years from when all of this kind of started. And I spiraled big time. And I was a mess for months. And honestly, I didn't think that I could survive. I didn't think that that there was a way out of the pain that I was in. And what was happening is the drugs and the alcohol that I was using, they just weren't working anymore. You know, there's only a certain degree of pain, I think, that drugs can mask, and you get to a point where they stop working, or there's just not enough on the planet to use. And so I made the decision to take my own life. And thankfully, gratefully, I did not succeed. And I almost did. It was a rather brutal suicide attempt. And so I kind of came to in the hospital the next day, and realizing that I had survived, I just realized, okay, there must be another way. There's got to be another path. If I'm still here, there's got to be a reason. And so now I've got to find what that is. So I willingly went to treatment, and went to a 28-day rehab. And this person came into rehab to kind of speak and share her story. And that happens a lot in recovery spaces, right? We stay active and we share our experience, strength, and hope. And I will never forget what she said, because it has stayed with me, and it's one of my daily monikers, and that's that her secrets kept her sick. Mm-hmm. And my treatment facility was not trauma-informed in any way, shape, or form. It was very traditional 12-step. But when she said that, for me, it just made me realize, like, all this stuff that I had been running from, all this baggage that I have been like packing and stuffing and not dealing with. Here's this amazing, beautiful, healing person who's telling me if I deal with those things, they're actually going to be my freedom. They're going to be my keys to my freedom. And so for whatever reason, I just intuitively put that together that, all right, I need to start working on this and I need to start dealing with this. And writing was the only safe place for me to do that initially. So I started writing a lot, and then I, you know, got out of there and found a great therapist. I was really lucky to find a really good therapist. I worked a 12-step program really hard, had a therapist, and put those two things together and just started to build, you know, one day at a time and get some recovery time under my belt. And then I started to actually heal. And that's a whole process. And we'll get into that because my latest book, Awakening Blackout Girl, really talks about like the things that we need to do in order to go deep and pull that stuff up and out and really work on it so that we don't repeat those mistakes, so that we don't go back. Or if we do fall back a little bit, it's temporary and we can kind of spring forward again. And so I ended up going to college. I ended up moving to State College, Pennsylvania, which is home to the Pennsylvania State University. And I was there for about a year. And finally, my therapist kind of looked at me and she was like, you know, you're a really smart girl. Why don't you go to college? So I was 22 when I got clean and sober. And I didn't go to college because I barely graduated high school. Like I was a complete wreck, right? I barely went to school. I had like a 1.3 average. And it wasn't because I was stupid. I just didn't go to school. I didn't show up. I never took my SATs because I was out partying the night before. So I didn't think college was something I could achieve, that it was accessible to me. And, you know, she said, no, you can apply. You're now a resident here. You can apply for like provisional status. And so I did. And when I did, in my application was the first time I actually told my story kind of outside of that safe confines of either my notebook or my therapist's office or like a recovery meeting. And I got in. And so I started going to college and I absolutely just fell in love with learning and, you know, this whole new way of life. And I had been carrying one additional secret, and that was that I was gay. And I had known that since kindergarten. But again, it was another thing. I got really bad messaging from my parents, from family, from friends. And so it was just another thing that I used over and I ran from. And so I didn't come like gently out of the closet. I came like flying out of the closet. And I was just like, I was so alive for the first time, you know, having been in this like cocaine induced stupor for 10 years, I was just waking up to all of the injustices in the world. And then, you know, coming out of the closet and going through my own personal and physical transformation, you know, like I shaved my head, I stopped wearing makeup, I dressed real, you know, baggy clothes. And I was really just trying to find myself because I had not known who I was for a very, very long time. And so then I quickly had a very different experience with the world. And it was mean and it was cold and it was hateful. And you know, I started to really understand and appreciate what oppression felt like and discrimination. And eventually I became a victim of a hate crime. And that hate crime, when that happened, a person called the victim advocate reached out to me. And I had no idea that this field even existed. I didn't know that I was going to school for drug and alcohol counseling. That's what I wanted to do. And then this whole world of criminal justice opened up to me and I learned about victims' rights and victim advocacy, and I got hooked. And that was kind of what set my career into motion. And I've spent 20 years doing this work, as you indicated in my bio, in a variety of different ways. And, you know, I don't think I'll ever do anything other than victim advocacy.
And in a horrible way, you know, we talk about people finding their way to the perfect place for them to be. And you found your way in all the most horrible ways, but then mm-hmm. who else could do this work? If you're just tuning in, you're listening to my guest, Jennifer Storm. She's the author of 6 books, including Blackout Girl and Awakening Blackout Girl, and revisions to her story. Because after 23 years of doing this work and 10 years since the first book came out, you've learned more about, I'm sure, yourself and victims' rights and how things have changed or not changed. And mm-hmm. what I thought was interesting as you told the story, that you went through, you know, kind of the rehab recovery from drug and alcohol use, but the actual personal growth or personal awareness, personal awakening didn't happen until after you were clean and sober and in school. And it was almost as if the coming out was the personal awakening, where the other part was getting healthy, but this was actually coming into your own. And how horrific it must have been to have been part of another crime at that point, once you come out and show, it's almost as if every time you bring yourself into the world smacks you back a few paces.
Yeah. It's an interesting way to look at it for sure. I think it wasn't until I was my true authentic self that I was able to kind of realize what the world really was. And let's be very honest, the world isn't always necessarily a very kind and loving place, right? We want it to be. We want it to be compassionate and amazing. And so, you know, in the beginning of my recovery, I was just like, oh, I was so happy and everything was wonderful and it was great. And then when I started to do the real work, you know, when you put down drugs and alcohol, that's a massive, huge, incredible embracing of a step. 9 times out of 10, there is a whole lot underneath that use that then has to be dealt with. And if it's not, then people will most likely just go back to drugs and alcohol, right? And it's why you see such a repetitive cycle with addiction. And it's also, you know, why we need trauma-informed rehabs and trauma-informed treatment, because we need to understand that for far too many of us, you know, the solution to our problem is our problem, right? And that really is it. Like, drugs and alcohol were my solution. My problem was my trauma. I didn't know that. And so everyone said, well, the drugs and alcohol are your problem. I'm like, no, they're not. No, they're not. They're helping me. They got me through 10 years, you know, dysfunctionally and certainly not unscathed and not unharmed, but they helped me survive. And So now I think, you know, I'm so committed to this work because I want survivors to know that there are other survival tools that are better, that are more healthy, that, you know, won't lead to more harm to yourself. So that's really where I live in the work right now.
Well, and that's been kind of a theme that's been underneath a lot of my shows this last year, is the level to which trauma plays a part in mental health across the board, whether it's sexual assault or PTSD or, you know, being abandoned as a child, that all of us in some way we have trauma, and the trauma is either dealt with, works through and leaves, or it gets packed away. And it seems to be the kind of new awakening of the mental health field, is that before we can treat anyone for whatever it is they're coming in the door for, depression, anxiety, phobias, like, you know, the big three, that we have to get to the source of that. That we stood behind this biology-based story that, you know, all mental health issues were biology-based. And so that, I think, slowed down our progress to recognizing that, yes, there might be a biological reaction to, right, what's happening, but it's the trauma that kicks the responses into gear, or kicks the biological change that leads to depression, anxiety into gear. And so I think, and I'm looking forward to your response to this, I think that the fact that trauma is so prevalent, you know, the statistic was one in every 2 women or 3 women will be sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And that's just one form of trauma. Yeah. But then think of ancestral trauma, intergenerational traumas, that almost every single person is traumatized. So then you almost have to throw up your hands and say, it's too big, right? Yeah. It's too big. We can't even deal with it. So let's just pretend it doesn't exist. Is that what we do?
No, I think we say, eureka, here's the solution, right? And now we need to make sure that our schools and everything in our community, all of our resources and all of our services are coming from a trauma-informed lens, because it's the prevention tool that we've been missing. And if we can intervene early on and we can engage in a trauma-informed way, think about what that'll do long term. I mean, we'll be able to avoid, hopefully, so many of the negative consequences that come from having adverse childhood experiences and having traumatic experiences. You know, I do this every day with my son. I have a 5-year-old boy, and I adore him and I love him. But he is this beautiful, brilliant white male. And so I know statistically, he is going to grow up in a society privileged. And I want him to understand and appreciate that privilege today. And so, I mean, I have been teaching my son consent since he was an infant, when I change his diaper? We ask, you know, all the way to he's a very like tactile kid. So he loves to hug, and he's just really super sensitive and sweet. And we had to teach him very, very early on in daycare, like, you can't just run up and hug people. You've got to ask. Like, you have body autonomy and agency, and so do other people. And so it's wonderful that you want to hug and you want to greet people, but you need to ask permission, because just like we tell you no one's allowed to touch you, you're not allowed to put your hands on anybody either. And we've had really tough conversations with him about this. And it's funny, now that he's five, he's getting into the whole girlfriend world where, like, well, she's my girlfriend and I have a girlfriend. And he's got this one friend, and we're really good friends with her mom. And at one point she was like, no, we're not girlfriend or boyfriend anymore. And he got really mad. And I had to have a conversation with my five-year-old son about possessiveness and jealousy, and that, you know, you're not entitled to her just because you like her. And at one point she told you she liked you too. She's allowed to change her mind, and you have to deal with that and accept that. And then we give him tools to deal with his emotions. I mean, this is stuff that, you know, I never had, you probably never had, right? Being an emotionally regulated child wasn't even a concept back then. You were to be quiet. You weren't to be, you know, seen or heard, or, you know, it was just a different way of engaging. And so I think it's the solution. Being trauma informed is the solution, and we need to invest in it and embed it in all of our resources.
And when we talk about being trauma informed, for people that don't live in that world of vocabulary, define what that means to come from a trauma informed place.
It means you're really seeking to understand this person and their behavior, as opposed to labeling it and judging it. That's what our system does, right? We slap labels on people, we prescribe stuff to them, and then we judge them away. And then when they don't succeed, we judge them some more, or we just over-medicate them, right? And so being trauma-informed is more like when someone comes in front of you and has done something, it's getting to the, well, let me figure out what happened in your life, or what happened to you that led you to this behavior, as opposed to what's wrong with you. Why would you even think of doing that, right? Instead of being accusatory and judgmental, it's being curious and compassionate and trying to understand what's going on so that we can figure out a way to avoid this behavior. It's not, I have this concept that I've dubbed compassionate accountability. So it's not saying that bad behavior is okay and that we should all just excuse it away because there's trauma behind that. No, we need to hold people accountable for their bad behavior. But instead of being just completely punitive, we need to seek to understand. If we really want that person to change and to be a better version of themselves, then we better invest in what's going on with them so that we understand it well enough. Because if we don't do that, I mean, that's why we see rehabs and prisons and probation. They're cycles, and people are just cycling in and out and in and out, or they're getting trapped in these cycles and they can't get out because they don't have the right tools and they don't have the right helpers around them.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Jennifer Storm. She's a survivor, the author of six critically acclaimed books about addiction recovery. She has also worked for 7 years as the victim advocate for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which we're going to dive into, and continued throughout her entire adult life working for and trying to bring about awareness towards recovery and addiction and trauma-informed work. I'm Elizabeth Baer. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And if you'd like to make a comment or have a question for Jennifer, our number is 805-549-8855. If you call in, Francisco will be happy to read your question over the air. You can also follow us on Instagram Live. We are streaming right this second. If you'd like to see Jennifer and myself in our conversation, just look for The Reluctant Therapist on Instagram and you can join us. And thanks and hello to everyone who is there. And if you'd like to ask a question, you can ask a question through Instagram Live as well. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to continue our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Stronger than me. You've been here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Not pale in comparison to who you think I am, 'cause you always want to tell the truth.
This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, KCBX. You're listening to A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. A friendly reminder that our spring pledge drive is underway and we're asking you to help us toward our goal. Remember that listener support provides the majority of the funds KCBX needs to operate. Renew your support or become a new member by visiting kcbx.org online or by calling us at 800-549-8855. We're continuing on with our conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Here's Elizabeth Barrett.
All right, so Jennifer, you graduated from college, and of course we don't have 5 hours because we could spend an hour just talking about how amazing it was that you actually recovered and went to college and earned your degree. So we'll already say that's amazing. But then on top of that, you go to work as a victims' rights advocate, which leads you to a position as the actually elected official for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. The victim advocate, right?
And that was appointed.
Okay.
Yeah.
But still, 7 years you're appointed by two different governors to do this work for the state of Pennsylvania. What does that entail? And in that time frame, when did you have time to write your first book?
So I started writing in rehab, right? Mm-hmm. I really did. I started writing Blackout Girl in rehab unknowingly. I was writing for healing and writing for my own kind of personal use. And then as I slowly, you know, began healing and writing more, I got into my first job, which was running a nonprofit organization helping victims of crime. And that's when I thought, you know what, I have a lot here and I'm not seeing my own story on the bookshelves. And that was 2008. It was 2007, actually, that I started looking. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just publish my own book. Maybe I'll see if somebody thinks my writing's worthy enough to publish, right? So I went to a bunch of different publishers and learned what rejection really felt like. And then I stumbled upon Hazelden Publishing. And it was mainly because most of the books that I had been reading at that time, my recovery books, were Hazelden books. Hazelden is the Betty Ford Foundation and Treatment Facility. And so I reached out to them and they decided to publish Blackout Girl. So they've been my publisher. So that came out originally in 2008. And that was not a time where we were speaking openly about sexual violence in this society at all. And it was also the economic downturn. If you remember, the housing crisis hit. Yeah. So also wasn't the best time to have a book. We'll talk about my publication timeline and you'll see I have horrible luck when it comes to book publication because I just released two books in a pandemic. But you know, the book really caught on and had an amazing readership and an amazing following. And I met so many wonderful people and I toured with it a lot. So that came out in 2008. And then I didn't get appointed to the position of victim advocate until 2013. So I was really kind of doing this work. And I was known as Blackout Girl all over the country. I had been going and doing keynotes and workshops and really talking about the interconnectivity of substance use disorder and victimization and trauma. And it was really probably, I know it was one of the prime reasons I was appointed to this position, right? I was a nationally known victim advocate here in Pennsylvania doing this work. And so that's what kind of drew the attention of the first governor. And then the second governor asked me to stay because I was doing good work.
And so what does that entail? I never knew that. And does every state have a victim advocate? Is this a common, what is that?
Yeah. So yes and no. Victim advocates, yes, are across the country. Every county, every jurisdiction has some type of a victim advocate or a victim services coordinator or a victim services assistant. You know, sometimes we're titled differently, but it's basically the field of victim advocacy. In Pennsylvania, we're a bit unique in that we have a statutorily created position called the victim advocate. And you are an independent entity. So even though the governor appoints you and the Senate must confirm you, you sit independent of the administration. And the point of that is because you need to hold everybody accountable, right? And sometimes that's the administration. And sometimes it's the legislature. And sometimes it's the, you know, the citizenry. Really kind of depends. So it's an independently created position. And you hold a 6-year term. And that is intentional to straddle, you know, what should be a bipartisan administration. And so the day-to-day is really post-sentencing rights. So it's anything that's going to, if the state is involved, the victim advocate is the one delivering those notifications and services. So think prison release, probation and parole, consideration and release, those kind of big things. And then legislation, policy, and really just advancing victims' rights and speaking out for victims and representing. I mean, literally one of the mandates of the victim advocate is to represent crime victims generally throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. So it's a very broad, almost intentionally vague kind of mission so that you are making sure that every single crime victim has a voice.
And so you happened to serve for 7 years during some very high profile sexual assault cases in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
So what was your role in helping the victims?
So I came into the role of the victim advocate already working on the Jerry Sandusky case. And that came to be because our attorney general's office at the time prosecuted Jerry Sandusky, who, as you know, was the coach at the Pennsylvania State University. And they didn't have victim advocates assigned, and they didn't do a great job in terms of the advocacy for those young men. And so by default, a lot of people started calling me and saying, these guys need help. Like, they need somebody to walk them through the system. And so I started working with a lot of them through their civil attorneys, ironically. And so I went through that whole criminal case with them and, you know, helped them pre and post. So that case was already kind of underway when I got appointed. And then this amazing thing happened called the Me Too movement, right? And it just cracked open the conversation of sexual violence in a way that we had never seen before. And people were coming forward in just massive numbers. And it was just story after story after story and headline after headline. And as we started to actually see belief, people believing survivors, it really empowered women and men to come forward and say, this happened to me, and this is the actor that did it. And we started to see these little slivers of accountability, slivers, right? There wasn't anything where it should be. And so in turn, we had women coming forward in Pennsylvania, and they were coming to me, and they were coming to me against senators and House representatives and people in really high profile positions, and then Bill Cosby. And so I started working with these survivors and, you know, in a variety of ways, and I can't get too detailed because of confidentiality, but helped them elevate their voices. And a lot of times folks were coming to me to be their spokesperson, to be their voice in the public realm, because that's really a hard thing to do as a survivor. And many survivors just want to maintain their anonymity, but they want to be heard, right? It's their privacy is really important. But if there's a bad actor somewhere and they know that they weren't the only ones, they want that actor held accountable. And so that got me into some tangles.
And you don't just mean actors. I want to make sure people understand that we're talking about those bad people, but they're not all actors.
Yes, sorry. That's just like a term of criminal art. Sorry. So when bad people who have done bad things, right? Whether they're a senator, a legislator, you know, regardless of who they are. And so I started telling a lot of stories, and I, you know, was going to police departments with survivors, and we were looking at different avenues of justice. And then we also had the Catholic Diocese report come out of Pennsylvania. So we had already had four or five different grand jury reports that basically said the Catholic Church has just covered up child sexual violence, has done a horrific job. But then we had the big report, which was the 40th grand jury report, that essentially said every single diocese in Pennsylvania knew about sexual violence, actively covered it up, paid off victims, and we were able to trace it all the way to the Vatican. So it was explosive, and Pennsylvania got an incredible amount of national coverage.
And so did this bode well for you or not?
Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. In one hand, I met and have worked with and now consider family and friends an amazing group of survivors that are just my heroes. And on the other hand, there were some legislators that, and specifically the most powerful senator in the state of Pennsylvania, a staunch Catholic, whose own priest was accused, had been actively engaged in covering sexual violence up for decades. And I was starting to poke that bear and started to unravel some of that to the extent that, you know, he was actively paying for a sexual abuser's legal fees that had been terminated from the Senate, but they were still mysteriously paying this predator's legal fees against the woman who accused him because she was suing. And so he did not take kindly to what I did, and I lost my job as a result of it. I mean, when you have, you know, people think that politics are really a democracy. They're not. It's traditionally a very small handful of very powerful white men who are in charge of everything, and what they say goes. And so he was in charge of my second vote. I had to be reconfirmed because I was renominated, and he did not allow that. So,
and that seems to be the theme, doesn't it, Jennifer? That mm-hmm. In not just in for women, but because we're talking about sexual assault and awareness month, primarily women and young girls, mm-hmm. that whenever women seem to get lifted in any way in our society, there is a backlash, starting with Susan Faludi's fabulous book 20 years ago that talked about the backlash, that mm-hmm. there is no room for women to come too far forward without a huge backlash yep. sending them. And you had it personally with your job. But yeah. then we see that the Me Too movement has also been very quietly squashed.
Very much so. Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Those cases, some have been resolved, but many just have dissipated because it's because when things get too big and overwhelming or too loud or women gain too much ground, there is a really systematic effort to pull back. So, yes. So how have you responded having lost that job? Where are you now in 2021?
Yeah. So initially was devastated, right? And the governor, so my position requires Senate confirmation, but that's not to say that the governor can't keep you in as acting. So the vote came down in November and the governor basically said, listen, I'm keeping you. You're just stay as acting. And I did that for a couple months, but quite frankly, it didn't feel right. And I am a person of very high integrity and morals and ethics. And so it no longer felt tenable to stay in the position when I knew, because I have to work with the Senate. You know, I have to, I'm constantly doing legislative work. And so I left in January. I decided to step down in January. So I was able to leave on my own terms, which was good and empowering. And I appreciate Governor Tom Wolf for allowing that to happen. And so now I'm working with this, I'm doing consulting work, but I'm working with this amazing nonprofit organization out of Portland, Oregon. They're a national entity. They're the National Crime Victim Law Institute. And they are a national nonprofit organization that protects and ensures the enforcement of victims' rights across the country. And so I'm at a place that I couldn't be happier with, and really working intentionally on ensuring that crime victims have access to adequate and free legal advice and legal representation when they're going through the system. And I'm loving it. I absolutely love the work that I do. I'm working from home. Obviously, I will be eventually traveling to Portland every now and then. But for the most part, I get to work from home, which I'm loving. And then I'm also contracting with another entity to take my book, Awakening Blackout Girl, and create a 10-week curriculum for survivors who are also dealing with co-occurring substance use disorder. So I'm really excited about that.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Jennifer Storm. She's a survivor, the author of 6 books about addiction and recovery. She has been a victims' rights advocate her entire adult life, and also proudly over 23 years of active recovery of her own. And so we're talking about Sexual Assault Awareness and Prevention Month, which is the month of April. The question I keep kind of poking you with is, but where is the national outcry? Because you're fired up. You've written these books. You're working for it with the NCVLI.
National Crime Victim Law Institute.
The National Crime Victim Law Institute. That's not on everybody's radar. Mm-mm. So there's a lot of interest at your level, but where is the national outcry? Where did the Me Too movement go? Where are we right now in our awareness and prevention?
I it's very much in line with what you said. It got so big and so massive and so loud that our society's response was Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, for 4 years, the messaging got so distorted and so manipulated that we all became the victims again, the aggressors, the liars, and the victim shaming and victim blaming that came out of that administration, and then empowered all of the individuals, unfortunately, in this world that think like him you know, like my senator. I mean, it lit him right up, like, oh, I can take this girl out now because I've got the support, and this Me Too movement seems to be fading. And it was weaponized. It was weaponized against us. And, you know, I'm not the only advocate in the country who has experienced this type of a backlash, who's lost their job, who's been defamed in this way for daring to speak up and speak truth to power. And so, unfortunately, we're at this muted place. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that with the shift in the administration, that we can slowly start rebuilding that narrative back and start telling the truth again, because it was just the truth. It wasn't like we were exacerbating anything or that we were saying something that wasn't 150% emphatically the truth. It was just it's a painful truth. And when it becomes a truth that then gets applied to heroes, it shifts the narrative and it changes things for people. And so it's okay for like John Doe down the street to be a sex offender, because I don't really know him and he doesn't impact me, but ooh, Kobe Bryant, I don't know. I don't know if we can talk about that because that's uncomfortable now, right? So it's, you know, right now we're seeing a resurgence with Woody Allen, where, you know, his daughter is finally feeling safe enough to step into her own space and share her story and see what he's doing. I mean, he's gaslighting everybody that he can. He's lying and he's manipulating his followers. And so it's hard. It's really hard. But we're not going to stop. And there are far too many of us amazing survivors in this world and warriors in this work that we're going to keep telling the truth. And we're going to keep, you know, I think it's funny that, you know, my senator, his whole thought, I guess, process of eliminating my job was that he was going to silence me. But if anything, he just emboldened me even more. I mean, my voice is now louder than it's ever been before, because now I'm not tethered to the government. I'm not tethered to any of that. So, you know, it backfired, and a lot of these attempts will backfire. But we have 4 years of trashing women, trashing the Me Too movement, and we've got to rebuild from that.
And isn't it interesting, because I talk about this every day, and until you connected the two, I went, oh, that's where the Me Too movement went. Because I got so gaslit about everything else that I actually forgot that the two were connected, that the whole national conversation got buried because of the leadership at the top of our. So you've been the kind of the new version of Blackout Girl, The Awakening, with updated content for the hashtag Me Too movement. Do you feel like you almost have to do another version again?
Well, no. So there's two books, actually. So there's Blackout Girl. So for any of those that are on Instagram right now, and that's the updated version of the 2008 memoir. So that's really my story. And then I went back in and just kind of added the narrative that I've experienced and I've lived, and really talking about the Me Too movement and the interconnectivity of sexual violence and trauma and addiction. And then I wrote a follow-up memoir to that, and that is Awakening Blackout Girl. And so that one just came out in October. And for me, this one, it's memoir self-help. It's really the, how did I do it? Like, how do I stay sober every day? How do I stay clean? How did I go into those really painful moments of trauma and heal myself? And then how do I do that every day? Because it's not a one, you know, you don't just go in, heal, and then you're like, okay, I'm all good. It doesn't work like that. There's a lifelong arc of trauma, and it's a continuum, and we live on that continuum. And so just because I don't pick up a drink or a drug today doesn't mean that I could be responding in a healthy way. And so there's things that we have to do every day to make sure that we're living in a healthy, healing way.
How do you know when you're good? How do you know when you're in a good place?
Yeah, I'm not angry. So for me, my trauma trigger comes out in anger. You know, like today I had a great day. Woke up, I got enough sleep. I got on my bike. I'm a cycler. So I got on my bike. I did my 10 miles. To some like great, you know, grungy 90s classic rock music. And so I got my stuff out, and then I just had a really productive day. I know though, if I didn't get enough sleep, I probably wouldn't have felt as great. If I didn't get on my bike and do that intense, important workout, that I probably would not have had a good day, right? So I know that there are things, there are like pillars in my recovery that I have to engage. And then there are just days where trauma shows up and it smacks you in the face, and you did everything right and it's still there, you know, and it's unavoidable. Like I said, Sunday was a really hard day for me. I only slept 4 hours the night before, and that's because I literally woke up at the same time that I came to when I was being raped. And I walked through for like the next 4 hours. I was wide awake walking through that entire experience. And that's not abnormal. You know, it's just because it was 34 years ago, it doesn't take the memory away. And it doesn't take it, certainly years of healing and working on that. Like, I wasn't up in a panic. I wasn't in a hypervigilant state. I wasn't sobbing hysterically. I was able to breathe. I was able to kind of be present through the moment and know what it was. But that's taken 34 years of work, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes when trauma comes and we aren't prepared for it, we haven't done the work, we are taken right back to that initial moment. So our blood pressure is soaring and our heart rate is pounding and we feel like we're losing our minds because we're reliving every single cellular part of that traumatic experience. So, you know, there are good days, there are bad days. But when you do invest in the healing, even the bad days aren't as bad as they were.
And you know, we use this term healing kind of in this broad general term in the mental health field. And so I always like to tap on people. And when you talk about healing, how do you define that? Because, you know, for some people it's getting on an antidepressant and that feels like healing to them. For another person, it's writing in a journal that feels like healing. For other people, it's letting it go or having it disappear. So when you use the term healing in your book, what are you addressing? What are people going to find?
Yeah. I mean, so healing is a verb, right? It's constant, it's active. And so for me, it just means that I'm living through my truth and I'm applying the healthy coping mechanisms around me to get through those moments. So even though I wasn't sobbing hysterically, there were lots of tears on Sunday because mm-hmm. part of healing is expressing emotion healthy and properly and knowing that it's okay to cry. Like there are certain things that are just sad and it's okay to cry. It's also okay to get angry sometimes, right? And I spoke a lot about this in the beginning of the pandemic when George Floyd was murdered. The anger that so many of us felt was okay. Like we were supposed to be mad. And then but the healing comes in synthesizing that anger into action, and action that can result in something positive, as opposed to action that could result in something negative. So I think healing is self-awareness. It's constantly knowing where you're at and then knowing yourself well enough to apply the different tools that you've collected through your healing process to get through that moment.
I also feel like there has to be an element of worthiness too. Mm-hmm. And a reason to get up in the morning. Like I would imagine meeting your wife, having your son.
Yeah.
Right. That does a lot for the healing.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my life is filled with joy, right? So, you know, even though this year has been really traumatic and I lost my job, I actually had a cancer diagnosis. I had to have a radical hysterectomy. It was like a whole thing. The pandemic was like 2020 was not a great year. But there were so many moments of joy and wonder, and I got to spend more time with my son, and I got to spend more time with my wife, and I got to work from home. I got to do more writing. I got to do more reading. I got to do more sleeping. So I think that, you know, joy exists and it's available, and it doesn't have to show up in the form of marriage. It doesn't have to show up in the form of children. But every survivor out there who has gone through something horrific and traumatic can access that joy. That it's there for them. It's just, it takes work. And you got to be willing to show up and do the work. And that's not always easy. But, you know, what I try to impress upon survivors every day. So I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I'm very active on social media. And the reason I am is because I want people to log on and see something affirming every day in relation to like their trauma and healing. Because it's hard. And, you know, I had a survivor reach out to me yesterday. She just said, I'm having a really weak moment. So, I came in with the affirmations and I came in with the support because that's what we do for each other. We lift each other up. And we need to be doing that more as a society and as a community to help people get through this because these are rough times.
And also, you know, again, I think it's another show we'll have to have down the road. We didn't get to address at all the cultural story that is telling Gen Z girls that once again, it is how you appear to look that is your value on the planet. And it's so hard to see those cycles repeat that we would kind of all of a sudden it's cool to be exploited. And I don't know if that makes sense to people unless you know Gen Z young women and see that, that somehow they've been convinced that this influencer Instagram hyper-sexualized exploitation of themselves is somehow empowering. And that message is strange to me because it's allowing yourself willingly to be victimized. But that'll have to be another conversation because I want to finish up kind of on an up note. One of the things you said, but the thing that stuck out for you is that secrets keep us sick. Mm-hmm. And all I keep thinking is if we would just say what we don't think we're allowed to say, change the world for everyone, because we've all grown up with these rules of what's okay to talk about and what's not okay in our families. And to bust that, because that seems to be the first thing is let's talk about the truth.
Yeah.
And Jennifer Storm, that is one of the things I think I love most about your book, what I love most about your Instagram and your willingness to just put it out there, every bit of your life and your story. And I think that that's what is healing for all of the people that find you. So thank you for your work that you do. Thank you for being here with me today. If people want to follow you on Instagram, your handle is?
Storm119.
And if they want to find out the work you're doing with NCVLI?
You can go to ncvli.org and that'll give you all the information about this phenomenal nonprofit organization.
And if you want to read Jennifer's latest book, how can they find it?
Anywhere. So anywhere books are sold. Yeah. Any book retailer, online, Amazon, all the booksellers, but also free and accessible at your library. And if your library doesn't have it, just ask them and they will order it for you. I never want cost to be a barrier to my books. So.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your time. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can listen to our previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show. Join us on Instagram, on Facebook. Send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And as always, thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Broken down and tired of living life on a merry-go-round, and you can't find the fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains, we gon' walk it out. Silences ain't quiet, and it feels like it's getting out of breath, and I know you feel like dying.